It's 2:28 a.m. in Los Feliz, and you're listening to Night Call.
Hello, and welcome to Night Call, a podcast for your strange days and lonely nights. I'm in Los Angeles. My name is Tess Lynch, and with me is
Molly Lambert.
And over in New York, we have
Emily Yoshida. We've had like three LA locations in a while. I just want to point that out. We've been very coastally biased recently.
I was just going to say, I made the decision to place us in Los Feliz because we will be talking about the Los Feliz murder house. But I realized while I was saying it that Los Feliz is one of the most debated, how do you say that place, places. Los Feliz.
Nobody says Los Feliz.
Should really be that. Well, you know, if you're driving, your navigator will say Los Feliz.
Your navigator.
Your navigator. Well, it's either way, an argument could be made. However, that's where we are.
Yes. We are.
Wherever we are, there we are.
Also, later in the show, we have a very special guest on. Brian Koppelman, co-creator of the show Billions, is on to talk about the girlfriend experience and chiropractic. Two great tastes that taste great together. So that's coming up later in the second half of the show. But right now, we have to hit some news because there's been some important UFO news.
Big Night Call news.
Over yes. Memorial Day weekend.
So the New York Times reported and then New York Magazine followed up with the fact that there have been a ton of Navy pilots, or I guess from 2014 to 2015, there were a number of UFO sightings by Navy pilots between Virginia and Florida off the coast. They didn't go ahead and say that these were extraterrestrial ships, but they couldn't explain what they were. And there were a couple of near misses where planes almost collided with them. And there are some details in the New York Times article about how the G-force, everyone was freaking out about the G-force because decelerating and accelerating are dangerous points. So if you have to decelerate because you almost collide with a UFO, it's not good.
It's bad.
It's bad. Yeah. So, yeah, there were a number, I think they said almost daily sightings
daily.
Of these. And this was the sightings were all reported to the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program, which we've talked about before on the podcast. Very secretive part of the Pentagon that deals with this kind of stuff. What do you guys make of this?
Cool as hell.
I mean, it just feels like recently there's just been so much declassification of all this. Now we know that there was so much, you know, research and recording being done about UFOs, like, all along.
Mm-hmm. Just like the X-Files promised me.
Yep.
They were right.
They were right. Also strange, so these sightings stopped being reported, and I guess that's because the pilots had relocated to go hit up ISIS in Iraq and Syria. So they weren't, you know, I think there were two pilots who were quoted in the article and then several others who wanted to remain anonymous. But yeah, so there was like this year-long thing of these UFOs. And then instead of really like digging into it, it was just that the sightings were reported and then left alone for a long time to marinate and then be discovered by the New York Times and Night Call.
I thought it was also interesting that, like, the way they described how they moved, which sort of sounds the way that you would imagine a kind of Hollywood UFO in, like, the 50s to move, just sort of hovering and then go whoop and leaving. Like, that, I thought it was funny that they described that as being, like, they knew that that would kill a human. For it to,
right.
I guess funny isn't the right
word.
Because
that was the G-force.
Like,
that's the G-force thing, right? Where they can't pivot and go this way and that way. It also is like, it's weird how the behavior of UFOs is so kind of similar in like all of these different tales. I think we, like literally a year ago, talked about Coast to Coast and the UFO sightings that were reported on the show.
An object that looked like a sphere encasing a cube.
Hmm.
Is how it is described.
That sounds, I mean, that sounds like Jodie Foster's something in contact, you know?
Well, it's also strange. Like, why would there be UFOs specifically in this area where fighter pilots test things? But they were like, that's why they said they knew it wasn't a commercial or a personal drone.
Yes. At first they thought it was drones, and then it turned out it couldn't be.
They were like, it can't be a drone because it's in this area that's just for, like, fighter pilots to practice. Mm-hmm. But then it's like, well, why would the UFOs go there?
Well, because if you were an alien, wouldn't you be like, Florida Keys? It's where I belong.
That's a real Jimmy Buffett alien chose. I enjoy that idea.
It seems odd that during a time of, like, there's so much kind of dramatic news politically and everything, then to slip in the UFO stuff when nobody has the bandwidth to really care.
That's part of what makes it feel like we're living in the future.
Yeah, yeah. That's been the thing about these past couple big, like, UFO revelations, is that it's like, come on, we have too much to worry about. You could have told us this a while ago. Told us in 2014 when we didn't care about anything.
Right. Then we would have been all over it. No, now it seems like part of the we're in the end times general feeling that we're getting.
I have to say, though, the best antidote to, like, the kind of, you know, reading this report and trying to figure out what to make of it and not really, like, having enough information, but just enough to be like, huh.
I love when the government is like, we don't really know.
And yeah, right. Like, yeah.
That's cool.
Our whole, it's classified, and we also don't know.
I read something else about, we talked about earlier, about Oumuamua.
Oumuamua.
Oumuamua. I read like a real scientist talking about Oumuamua and being like, oh, we thought it might be an alien spacecraft because, like, we're just going to find one any moment now.
Right.
And I was like, this guy's a real scientist.
Yeah.
And he really believes this. And then it turns out maybe there's just more stuff going on than any of us know about.
8, 5, 12, 12, 15.
This week's episode of Night Call is brought to you by Storyworth. Father's Day is coming up, and Father's Day, Mother's Day, all these great family holidays are always a great opportunity to get in touch with your family and remember all the great memories and things that make them special to you. And Storyworth is a great way to keep in touch and save all these memories and make them a part of your family's life. Storyworth makes it easy and fun for your loved ones to share their stories with weekly emailed story prompts, questions you've never thought to ask each other. At the end of the year, they'll get their stories bound in a beautiful hardcover book. Strengthen your family bonds and get to know your loved one in a whole new way. So when you join Storyworth, you get a subscription for someone you love, and each week, Storyworth will send them an email with a question about their life. They simply reply to this email with their story. All the stories are private and only shared with family that you choose. After a year, their stories will be bound in a beautiful keepsake book. It's a great alternative to social media and other less secure ways to stay in touch with family. In this case, it's all within your family. You can choose the questions, and it's a much more personal way to stay in touch with family and record all of these memories. You can also learn things about your relatives you never knew about, stories about their history and stories about their childhood that really bring you closer together. So some of the questions you might ask your family on this might be, what are some favorite recipes you remember cooking growing up? What was the first movie you remember seeing in the theater? What was it like going to college for the first time? So one of the things I used to love asking my mom about when I was growing up especially was about her Beatlemania. You know, she was a teen right when the Beatles came to America, and it was a big deal, and she even went to go see them in concert. And Storyworth would be a great way for me to kind of get that story from her in a really easy to access way. Ask her all the questions that I always wanted to about what it was like to see the Beatles in concert when she was 14 years old in Kansas City. It's a great way to just sort of preserve all these things in a way that really stands the test of time. So to join Storyworth and for $20 off of your subscription, visit storyworth.com/call when you subscribe. That's storyworth.com/call. Sometimes it's hard with families being spread out all over the place to get together for holidays and to share those memories together. And so Storyworth is a great way to help you bridge geographic distance by providing lively discussion topics. That's storyworth.com/call.
12, 9, 20, 5, 14, 5, 18, 19.
here's something really interesting that none of us knew about. And Emily found a really amazing, I guess I would call it a scientific blog post.
Yeah.
But this is like my favorite thing I've read in the past month, maybe. It is about a barnacle. Emily, where did
you find
this?
Well, I found this thanks to a Night Call listener, but I went back to try to figure out who sent it to us. And I think whoever did deleted the post, but luckily I still had the tab open so I could read.
Oh my God.
So thank you, whoever you are. No need to be ashamed of sharing this with us because we definitely wanted to talk about it.
It's the best.
This is called the rhizocephalon barnacle. The post, which we will certainly link to on social if you want to read more about it or know how to spell rhizocephalon, it's written in a very narrative style. So it sort of tells the story of what this barnacle does, which is essentially that it attaches itself to crabs, in this case, a male crab. And like undetectably over a long period of time, takes over its nervous system and also turns its reproductive organs into reproductive organs that create more rhizocephalon barnacles. So it basically can impregnate male crabs and make them into baby factories, is how I put
Hell
it in
yeah.
our notes. We stan this rhizocephalon.
May I please read some of this?
Because yeah, it's a like, great, it's a great just, post.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
In this scenario, it's written
in
with you as
person.
The male crab.
Yeah.
She looked normal once when she was young. As a juvenile, she looked like a normal barnacle larva, only a few millimeters long, but her juvenile body had one terrible difference. Her head was tipped with a needle protruding from her shell. When she found you, she used her body like a hypodermic syringe, stabbing you and injecting her own cells under your skin. It goes on. Then it says, just when it seems it couldn't be worse, your abdomen explodes. You're now sterile and her gonads are erupting out from where your genitals used to be. Her tumorous ovaries now attract a male rhizocephalon larva who injects his own cells into her. These grow into testicles within her body. She now has everything she needs for her next takeover, which is that she takes over your brain. And so you forget that you're a crab and you think you're a barnacle. And then
yeah.
you take care
you
of
take
the spawn
of, oh,
as if they
so
were your
great.
Own.
It's so
that
metal.
Rules.
It's
totally.
The hand that rocks the barnacle.
I was so delighted to read about this.
I know. I, for one, have always thought about how can we weaponize male pregnancy?
Mm-hmm.
Because if men could get pregnant.
If we only had little needles on our snouts.
Well,
I think
look.
That the real kicker, though, is the brain half of it. Because it's not just that it makes you reproduce this other species.
Yes.
That you want to take care of them. That is now you are now attached to them. Like that.
Yeah.
That's how you really take over. That's how you weaponize pregnancy.
It's amazing. But please go read the whole thing because it's like, it's so good.
It's
I feel,
jelly,
I think in the comments there was, yeah,
.com.
The comments were good, but not, they didn't like really give props enough to the writing of this. It was a wild ride.
Aliens are among us already.
Exactly.
Under the sea. Like if you found out there was an alien that could do that, people would be so freaked out. And then you're like, guess what? It exists already.
It's species for
in
real.
Don't get poked.
Yeah, don't get poked.
Don't get poked. One final bit of news. Human composting will be legal in Washington State. Yay.
Oh, it will be
yes,
legal?
I'm so excited to be composted. I think it's the perfect solution.
Thrown into the flower bed.
What do I do with myself? Yep.
Is this the mushroom suit?
No.
This isn't like you can bury your body in a flower bed.
I think it is like a scientifically assisted version of that. I don't think that there's any cremation involved in this.
Right.
Well,
composting.
As we talked about once before, there's a mushroom suit, which is like a thing they seal you into, and then the mushrooms take over your body. And that's what Luke Perry did.
Oh,
that's awesome.
R.I.P. Yeah.
I love that he did that.
Awesome?
That's awesome.
That is beautiful.
Me too.
Let the bodies hit the earth.
Let the... Yeah. Let the bodies hit the earth and make beautiful flowers. Would you eat vegetables harvested with your friends' ashes?
You know what?
With my friends, but not my enemies.
Not your enemies, but like someone you love. You would eat like the tomato from the...
I think I'd rather it be someone I don't know in a way.
Really?
I would rather have it be somebody that I know. I honestly would. Yeah.
What if the tomato? Yeah. What if you don't care what kind of person you're getting in your
I'd
tomato?
I'd rather it be anonymous. If it's someone I know, it's gonna like I'm just gonna be sad eating the tomato.
Oh no! It'd be like giving them one last hug.
With my guts.
With your guts.
A gut hug. Well, in far more depressing news, I guess maybe not life after death, there's the Los Feliz murder house that we've talked about before on the podcast has once again been placed on the market. It's a weird situation, you guys. It is very strange. Curbed LA covered it. This house is the house on, I believe, Glendower in Los Feliz, and it was the scene of a murder-suicide in 1959. A doctor killed his wife, attempted to kill his teenage daughter, and then killed himself.
I will say also not to be confused with the other Los Feliz.
Oh, there's
murder
many.
House,
there's mm-hmm. many.
Which there
this
are many.
Is not the Soudan
when people
house or
first saying, yeah, yeah, when people were first saying the Los Feliz murder house, I always thought they were talking about the La Bianca.
The Manson one?
Well,
house?
Sometimes yeah. they turn, yeah, sometimes this is the Los Feliz murderer's house, mm-hmm. and sometimes it's the murderer's mansion. Mm. Either way, this is known as like the one that was basically a time capsule, because after these crimes occurred, the house was passed to a different family who never moved in. The son, who was the surviving member of that family who had the house for a number of years, used it apparently as some kind of like just a storage facility for his stuff, which was strange. But it began to attract a lot of people who wanted to look in the windows, because it was rumored that there was a Christmas setup, like a tree and presents from back when the crimes were committed. That turned out to be false, because the doctor who committed the murders was Jewish. And so then it was like, okay, maybe it was the next family, which would have placed it probably in the 70s. Either way, it was a strange, untouched, weird interior that then was bought by Gloria Allred's daughter, Lisa Bloom, and her husband 3 years ago. They wanted to expand it. They started renovations. They tore out the whole inside. They tore it down to the studs. And then abruptly put it back on the market for $3.5 million. They're only accepting cash offers. And I'm assuming that people would know that it's because it's like filthy with ghosts. They put out a statement saying, oh, we ran into all sorts of permitting problems. We wanted to expand the house, but we'd have to regrade the hillside. It's going to be too expensive. So now we're going to list it at like $1 million something more than we bought it for. And it's torn apart. Go to. Bring your cash.
Yeah,
definitely
it's all
not
cash
haunted.
Only for sure.
Cash? Who has $3.5 million in cash?
Nobody has $3.5 million dollars in cash. Are you kidding me?
Yeah. Someone who deserves to be haunted.
Right, we got to go to Vegas.
Yeah.
Make $3.5 million in roulette and then buy the Los Feliz murder house to be the Night Call compound.
I mean, it looks great.
I seriously don't want to live in that house. I am 100% sure.
We just
sure
have parties there.
Haunted.
We'd burn it to the ground.
I posted about this on Twitter, and we received a night call from a paranormal investigator.
Right, because you were talking about like, if you were to if it was a total tear down and you just built another house on that land, would the house still be haunted? I believe that was your question.
That's my question. Yeah. Because I'm wondering if when Lisa Bloom tried to do the renovations, like, was she thinking that she would just raise the house and for some reason she just couldn't? I mean, is it really that, like, maybe you have to stay within
the same... No, she saw a ghost and she got freaked out.
That's what I think.
Clearly.
Yeah. Didn't want to go back.
So we have a night call from Z.
So we have this email from Z, and Z says, "Hey there, I'm Z, Portland native and co-founder of the All Lady Paranormal Investigations team, Hella Paranormal Investigations, and the Ghosts and Hoes podcast." That's Hoes, of course, E-A-U-X. On to the questions. To start, there are different kinds of hauntings. Residual hauntings are usually the ones attached to land and are basically an imprint repetition of a past event that happens on a loop. Okay, but what the fuck does this have to do with ghosts? Well, sometimes we forget that the earth is a living thing. Some areas and materials are more prone to absorb energies and others radiate them. Look up the Oman House in Beverly Hills. Residual hauntings are fairly common, and while they can be startling AF, they're pretty benign and can't harm you. An intelligent haunting is when a spirit or entity can, and often will, interact with you. Small things being moved, a knock in response to you asking the entity to make itself known, like the Maitlands from Beetlejuice or the entity from the first Poltergeist movie. Not all dark entities or violent hauntings are demonic. As far as getting them to leave, I know everyone's first instinct is to grab some sage, but please calm down. Sometimes you literally just have to ask. There are different ways of removing unwanted paranormal guests, but it all depends on who or what is in your home. When in doubt, find a local professional to help you. And if they tell you they charge for their services, you kick them straight in the taint and tell them to suck your dick. No one should be charging for that. That is blatant horse shit dickery. But this is already an essay, and I can go into that another time. Or you can listen to Ghosts and Hoes and hear me and my BFF Danielle talk about it. Wink.
Thank you so much for that.
That was great.
Very informative and good. The Oman House is the house, I believe, that was built right by Cielo Drive, where the Manson murders took place, was demolished and the address no longer exists. So the Oman House, I believe, was then built like, a, you know, kind of on part of that land. And is haunted. Like, the land is haunted. It didn't matter that they changed the address or destroyed the
house. What has happened there?
I think we've said this before, but America is haunted.
America's very haunted.
Yeah. Like, there's no part of America where there were not genocides and murders, so...
Or burial grounds.
Yeah. So, I was very interested in what she said in the email about... like it being a movie replaying over and over again. Because I feel like we've heard that from other people, specifically
Rachel Handler.
Handler was the guest talking about like you see something over and over again and you like don't, you can't interact with it exactly. Yeah. But
it's like a shadow, an echo of something.
Right. And then you have to ask it to leave nicely, I guess.
I mean, I love just asking.
And it probably says no. Why would it leave? I mean, that's what's interesting about thinking that ghosts are kind of like...
because you give it permission.
Stuck in this loop.
Right, maybe, they're in purgatory and you give them, you free them. That's what horror movies have taught
me
to do.
Well, also in the case of a ghost from this grisly murder in Los Feliz and everybody who's tried to develop the house or remodel it or do whatever with the land being, we think, scared away by it. I mean, most of the time when I've heard, like Rachel is a great example. I feel like we've heard several other examples of this. If you encounter a ghost or something that feels like some kind of what she's calling like a residual haunting, it's not, most people don't report it being like a scary thing. It's just sort of a like, oh, there's somebody else here type of feeling. So that's my question is like, why has this been a universally negative experience? Is it just because of the nature of the death? Is it like, is it always going to be that kind of haunting as opposed to just a kind of like benign, somebody's just hanging around because their life got cut short too soon or whatever?
I mean, this sounds prohibitively bad. Something
it's
about
bad.
It is clearly
it's bad. It's
bad,
you guys. I know it's bad. I've driven by. It's bad. It's you just bad. Get a very strong vibe.
Trust the vibe.
Yeah. I feel like my husband was like, we should drive by. And I was just like, no, we're not going to go back there. Mm-hmm. I'm so sorry. I just can't. That ghost is a bad ghost.
Well, if you've seen any ghosts that you would like to tell us about, give us a night call at 240-46-NIGHT.
That's right.
Or you can email us. At nightcallpodcast@gmail.com. We'll be joined now by Brian Koppelman for a little chat.
Hey, folks. If you love true stories about extraordinary life experiences, we think you'll love the Risk Podcast. Risk is the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. Stories too uncensored for public radio. On Risk, nothing's too intimate or too strange. Like the one about the guy who got kidnapped by the drug cartel, or the girl who discovered she was living with a cannibal, or the woman who learned the person she was sharing kinky fantasies with online was her dear old dad. You'll hear real people sharing about life experiences so funny, so scary, so mystifying, you won't believe your ears. Find it all at riskshow.com or just search on your podcast app for Risk. That's R-I-S-K exclamation point or risk-show.com.
So we are now joined by Brian Koppelman. He is, of course, first and foremost, a fellow Grantland colleague of all of ours from a while back. He's also the co-creator of the Showtime drama Billions, which you may know of, may have heard of. And he also wrote and co-wrote many films, including Rounders, including The Girlfriend Experience, which we're fans of here. Hi, Brian. Welcome to Night Call.
So happy to be here with you guys. Yes. Grantland alum. All Molly had to do was just ask. Just I was like, of course.
Throw up the signal. Yeah. So you've been working on this very New York centric, money centric, like finance world centric show, which I think is so interesting after having come from writing Girlfriend Experience, which is such a like, I don't know, it feels like just like this origin story of like the world that Billions takes place in now, in a way. Like,
yeah, it feels like you're the financial crisis.
You know, I mean, the Girlfriend Experience came out of trying to understand a new kind of transactional relationship that had supposedly top notes of empathy and intimacy attached to it. And David Levine, who's my lifelong creative partner, and Steven Soderbergh, the three of us came up with that because we were all at a hotel, the Mandarin Oriental Hotel, together in Columbus Circle, and we were down in the bar area and noticed this older dude with this college-looking, beautiful, sophisticated girl who was clearly working him, and Levine offhandedly said, "Oh, look at that, the Girlfriend Experience," and it was clear because we knew that bar at that time, this stuff was going on. And Steven said, what do those words mean? And we said, well, there's this new movement going on, mm-hmm. where this service is being sold that has a facsimile of intimacy. And then Steven started talking about all these relationships that are like that now, right? The broker relationships, the relationship you'd have with a trainer or your yoga teacher. And as we all started talking about it, we realized that this was a way to tell what seemed like one story. You know, there's very little sex in the movie. Mm-hmm. And we realized it was a way to tell a story that seemed like one thing that was really about something else. Mm-hmm. And so to me, that idea of telling a story that seems like it's one thing at first and it's about something else,
yeah.
is what we do on Billions for sure. And so I see the connections in that way. I'll say a huge difference is that The Girlfriend Experience is a largely improvised movie. It's the only improvised movie that David and I were involved with, whereas Billions is tightly, tightly scripted.
How do you do that? Well, when you write something that you know is going to be largely improvised later, like what do you do around that?
You're doing an incredibly detailed outline. Also, David is one of the stars of Girlfriend Experience. He's the screenwriter. He plays the screenwriter.
Yeah.
With whom Sasha starts to have a relationship. So then Dave would have some measure of control in a way. And Steven, you know, that was an art movie made for very, very, very little money when Steven was experimenting a lot. And he's a genius. So we felt very comfortable because Soderbergh's such a genius working in that way. Mm-hmm. We did an incredibly detailed outline where you write not just what the scene's going to be about, but sort of in a granular way, what should be covered, what everybody wants in the scene. And then Steven and Dave, and everyone's there to sort of make sure that it goes the right way. Also, Steven had this idea to cast real people. So the guy who plays the trainer, the kind of star, the other star of the movie along with Sasha, Chris Santos, was mm-hmm. a trainer in New York who we knew. And so you're basically telling Chris, this is what has to happen in the scene, but say what you'd say. Steven mm-hmm. didn't cast any actors mm-hmm. in that film. Sasha mm-hmm. was the only professional actor
right.
in that film. And I don't think Sasha was in SAG.
Oh, right, yeah.
At that time, and now she is, but I don't think Sasha was in SAG then. Wow.
Was it shot on digital?
Yeah, Steven shot that on the Red Cam.
It was a Red Cam.
Yeah, I remember being, I love all those digital.
Early Red Cam. Year.
Yeah, I mean, he's been a Red Cam person for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Well, I loved it too, because like, I was the person, I feel like Emily and Tess and I were all in film school right when it was switching over, and so people were very firmly divided into camps of either like you're shooting on film or you're shooting on digital.
It was a class divide.
It was super classified. But I was always like, the people, like, why wouldn't you shoot on digital? Like, explore the possibilities of digital. And I feel like Soderbergh always, you know, whatever the new thing is, he's like finding the way into it.
Yeah.
Yeah, he always knows. He always knows what's worthwhile and what's next. I mean, he is a brilliant filmmaker. We got to make like three movies with him and learned more from him than from anybody else, really.
It's such a great time capsule. I would encourage anybody who's listening who hasn't watched it lately or maybe hasn't seen it at all. It's such a, I watched it maybe a year ago or maybe a little bit less, and it's such an incredible time capsule of 2008. It takes place over the election, the Obama election, and it's just like plopping you right back down into
and
it.
And I'll say then we can move on, but
yeah.
We interviewed, what was incredible about that was the other thing that you can do in that sort of thing is try to get as much of the world you're depicting right and accurate so that it's easy for the people to improvise within it. So David and I interviewed maybe 40 $2,000 an hour escorts with Stephen there most of the time, and they would just tell us everything about what that life was like. And then to have Sasha, who wasn't a prostitute but was a sex worker in a way, there just immediately gave the thing the imprimatur of legitimacy, because Sasha had experienced having to manage these transactions herself. Yeah.
It's such a complex psychological, you know, proposition to just be like, you have to manage all these people, but also like look like you're not managing them. Like,
and,
yeah.
Right. And she's amazing because, I mean, Sasha's so smart. And the fact that she sort of from the beginning of her career was aware, okay, I have this toolkit. I want certain things out of my life. I actually see a path to do something in a way nobody's done before. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she looked at what Jenna Jameson had done and realized, I'm not saying Sasha's smart, and realize like, well, wait, I think I'm smarter than she is. I think I understand media because I'm of a generation after watching what she did.
Yeah,
I think I can actually use this to propel myself. You know, I'm also going to be honest about what I want sexually, and then I'm going to use it in a way to gain momentum and throw myself into this other career. You know, she's a really important DJ now.
Yeah.
And
yeah, she's a great DJ, I was going to say. I feel like she and Emily have the same taste in
music. I was going to say one of the most flattering things that anybody ever told me was Molly, when you saw her once, I think it's in a family, and you said you thought she was me at first. And I was like, thank you. I mean, she's about like 2 feet shorter than me, but thank you.
Awesome. Yeah. So I think, you know, if you think about the thematics of what that movie was, the fact that Sasha ended up being able to ride all this to this place in the culture that I think only Sasha Grey occupies. Nobody else is like her, who has a million followers or however many on across Insta and Twitter, but manages it without really now any posts that have sort of anything to do with her sexual image. She's sort of transcended in a way that everyone knows it. It's all part of who she is. It's incorporated. But she's been able to sort of move forward, which is fascinating to me.
I think that's a very common thing now, that it sort of doesn't matter what you get notorious for as long as you use it as a platform.
Yeah, right.
Because that's also like the Kim Kardashian thing, obviously. Not that she uses it as a great platform or anything. But just sort of the idea that like
it's all a part you can make of your, the mythology.
Yeah, it's all in the game.
Yeah.
And now everybody is in the transactional economy. So that movie is also very prescient about that.
Yes. I was going back and looking because, Tess, I think you brought it up on our last episode, the Cut article that Jane Marie posted about how to like make it, like what side hustles you can do to like make.
Oh, yeah, the side hustles. It made me so depressed.
They took down, you posted that they took down
they
the.
They did. They the took MLM down the MLM one. Part.
They did.
Of it. Oh. But a lot of those are just.
And they
like,
also said, don't sell your hair. They changed.
It was such a mess, that post. If you wanted a really great summary of how depressing the economic landscape is right now, it was a perfect.
Oh, nothing's more depressing right now than aspirational journalism.
But I thought it was sort of striking that like a lot of the things on it were, they weren't even like full blown services. It wasn't like become a housekeeper or like, I guess it was dog walker on there. A lot of it was just like sell off aspects of yourself, like your voice, like do voiceover work on Fiverr or something. It's like finding ways to like
sell
slice
your
off
kidney.
Parts of or your kidney or whatever.
Plasma.
Which you can't really translate into a second career so well, like compared to
being
a
porn
star.
Well, you can only sell your kidney once is the problem. Right. You can only really, like if you sell your hair, then you have to wait for your hair to grow back before you can sell your hair again. Kind of a flaw.
It is a flaw. I mean, the whole thing was very flawed.
Or if we figure out how you regenerate kidneys over and over again.
Sure. We'll work on that.
That's where the money is. Growing kidneys.
Impossible kidney.
But we wanted to take a night email while we had Brian in the room, because it turns out we have a chiropractic expert / enthusiast in our midst.
Just because I knew the word subluxation?
Subluxation. I didn't know the word subluxation. It's all news to me. Yes, we have an email this week from Coco.
Hello, Night Call. A while back, you discussed if chiropractic medicine is bunk, occult, etc. I do enjoy having my back cracked by a professional, but there is definitely a cult connection with a certain subgroup of the field. I moved to the Bay Area about a decade ago and met a longtime LiveJournal friend who lived in San Francisco. She commented on growing up in a chiropractor cult in Sacramento. Her parents were apparently heavily involved in this group that was super into energy work and chiropractic healing. A couple years ago, another friend asked if I was interested in a temp job she had done previously. It was working reception at a chiropractor's office. When I met the boss, she was a super friendly 30-something woman who had gone to chiro school. But what she practiced, she explained, was something called network spinal analysis. In network, you are rarely physically touched. Sessions are called entrainment. It seems to have a lot more in common with Reiki. I've read it a million times, but I never said it out loud. You lie on a massage table in a room with two to three others, something about communal energy, and people frequently scream or shout or cry. I once had my boss tell me to imagine breathing through a hole in my back like a whale. Okay, so a little weird. They offered me free sessions while I worked there, which was great because it was wildly expensive, recommended three times a week, and rarely covered by insurance. My boss gave me a workbook written by Donnie Epstein, the founder of Network, and encouraged me to come to the annual conference that summer. After I'd been temping a couple weeks, I saw my friend from Sacramento. I told her about this weird chiropractor I was working for, and she was like, dude, that's the fucking cult I told you about. She was a little freaked out to hear I had agreed to entrainment sessions, but understood that I was not on board with the worship of Donnie. The weirdest thing is that I've struggled with back pain and posture for a long time, and I had measurably better posture during the few months I received network care. No idea how it worked. Good night, Coco.
Thank you, Coco. It seems like it's a big San Diego thing. She said that was in San Diego, right? Or San Francisco?
Well, her friend was in Sacramento.
Sounds like California.
Yeah, it
sounds
like California.
I'm pretty sure I was in a room with Donnie Epstein once.
Really?
Yeah. What happened?
Was talking about this. I'm just looking it up, and I'm going to go, I'm 89% sure I was in a room with him.
How did you arrive in that room?
I was around someone in the self-help field who I don't want to name at the moment.
Okay.
And I believe Donnie Epstein was there as well, and they were talking about this energy healing stuff.
So Reiki is when you like put your hands over somebody but don't touch them.
Yeah.
It's energy healing, I believe.
There's this book that if you all haven't read or talked about on the show, it's so up your alley. It's called like The Full Facts Case on Cold Reading. And it's written by this British guy, and it's expensive to get, but it is. He goes step by step with every single aspect of how cold readings are done, you know, which is the mind reading thing and the way in which we're all susceptible to it, why we're susceptible, how we're tricked. And in it, he goes through every single technique so that if you say, no, but what my friend said, it's in the book, like all the techniques and all of this stuff. So chiropractic is separate because there's utility to certain kinds of chiropractic. I have given this a lot of thought in my life. And I think now, if you're a chiropractor and you're listening, don't hate me. This is just my personal truth.
I'm sure
your personal truth is different. And chiropractic is incredibly healing when it's for a purpose. If you need to get your back cracked because for various reasons and you feel better and it's therapeutic for you, that's great.
Yeah.
But Reiki, this kind of supposed energy healing, is all about the emotional thing that happens to you. It's like, you know how somebody can sit down across from a therapist for the first time and merely being in that setting can make you crack?
Yes, yeah.
You break?
Yeah. That's what it sounds like happened to Emily with acupuncture.
I just sweat a bunch, but still.
That's a legitimate thing, right? You're in this environment created for you to have catharsis.
Yeah.
And we need, we're in a society that we have to find moments of catharsis, moments of relief.
And we need to
release.
Create a like permission structure to let ourselves have that space, even if that's all
right.
It is.
That's right. And so, I had back pain, really bad back pain for a period of time, the kind where they x-ray you and then say take cortisone shots and do all this stuff. And so I started reading John Sarno's books, Healing Back Pain, which is Howard Stern talks about a lot. And in those books, he talks about all these different forms of therapy. And why you don't need them to get better. And in fact, what you need is to give yourself permission to get better.
Right.
And that if you do, you can most of the time. And so do I believe there's a cult? I mean, people use the word cult. What do you guys think? Like, I meditate, right? I do TM.
Right.
You know, you only have to scratch a little bit for people to start talking about why it's a cult. Now, I'm someone who practices it.
Right.
There's nothing cult. I've never been approached in any way culty.
Right.
But
this is what we were talking about.
TM is so expensive. My issue with TM is that it's, you know, when you read the responses, because they respond on like message boards and stuff to accusations that it's so expensive that that makes it suspicious. And a lot of the TM, you know, social media team will say, well, we really want to make it accessible to all. So we have like a lower tier, but it's still.
I love that you know about the TM social media team.
I was looking into TM, but I felt like it was prohibitively expensive in a way that made me very suspicious of it. But I do know people love it.
You can practice it for free.
You can, but who's going to give you your mantra?
That the David Lynch Foundation, so I had this huge skepticism. I remember the first time I went, I felt like, oh, I bet I really need something like this. And I spoke to Bob Roth, who's like the famous guy who runs the David Lynch Foundation. He's sort of the head of TM in a way. And I said, I think you guys are maybe a cult, or you were. And I said, also, just talk to me purely scientifically. And then I read all the stuff about the EEGs, and I read books. And what I have found out, and it seems to be, this seems to be true, and documented, and like you can find it, is they do give away hundreds and hundreds of thousands of TM lessons a year to veterans, school kids in at-risk areas. I do think that they largely, I'm not an expert on this, it seems to me they largely use the money to do a lot of good. The David Lynch Foundation in particular. I don't know about TM at large. And they definitely, I've seen them give people a break on the price when people need it. They have to train these teachers.
Right.
And it is, for me, highly therapeutic. For whatever that means, it helps. It's helped me be less anxious, and it's helped me creatively. So,
yeah, it's a mode that you respond to, at least for like a mode of
exactly
relaxation or centering or whatever.
And watch Penn and Teller's bullshit about chiropractic, because
I will watch that.
Yes,
because the subluxation, which is, I think people should look it up, where they talk about sort of like, by doing the chiropractic modality, they can make your digestive system better, or they can make you this. Supposedly, it's all trapped in this subluxation is how it gets better. That stuff's just, to me, bullshit.
Right.
And rather than just saying, hey, this is a form of physical therapy that can make you feel better, which then is fine. It's useful for sports medicine. It's a good sports medicine, chiropractic.
Sure.
That's it.
It's like, but I think it's like there's a need maybe to scientific it a little bit for people who don't believe in that kind of thing, or don't just accept the basic premise that if you let yourself lie down on a table and let somebody just like take care of you for a second, which sounds like one thing that it's not. But
this is the thing, is like going back to network spinal analysis, I found an article from the LA Times from 92, and it says network uses light touches and taps rather than jarring aggressive manipulations, the back cracking standard in many chiropractors' offices. The taps often leave patients crying, laughing, yelping, or shaking as they re-experience traumatic events. I've cried my guts out on the table, says singer-songwriter Roseanne Cash. It's incredibly powerful. It's been life-changing for me. My body definitely feels better. I definitely have more energy. So it's basically...
I think that's Johnny Cash's daughter, by the way, Roseanne
Yes,
Cash.
Exactly. And it says that it has like
okay,
a huge celebrity
I object,
following.
Though. Yeah. Hold on. I have to object. I have to object to defining Roseanne Cash that way. No, Roseanne Cash is like literally one of the most successful songwriters and singers.
No, you are right. And Brian is right.
Yes.
She put the C in
Both
country.
She is literally like as good at making music as anyone of... She's truly incredible.
I'm more surprised that she was involved with this back organization.
Yeah, apparently it was very, very trendy in 1992, enough so that they referred to it as like a celebrity thing.
I mean, that's my belief, is that a lot of these self-help movements are really about like networking and people making friends.
I just read her
autobiography,
Roseanne's. I'd say Reiki does not figure heavily in the book. And for whatever that's worth.
Okay.
That
kind
of thing we were talking about last week. We had a call kind of about like what defines a cult, whether it's behaviors or whether it's the actual belief and the workings of the religion or whatever it may be. And it feels like, I think that TM is probably a good example, from what I understand, a good example of one of these things that gets called a cult because of the practices and because of kind of the trappings of it and the way that it looks, and less so about how the group actually functions. What the, like?
Well, it doesn't mandate. I mean, I don't. Right. In the '60s, it might have been a different.
Right. Or thing. Like the like Maharishi school or whatever might be a different kind of thing. But yeah.
I mean, these people all did train with the Maharishi. They all yeah. trained with him and everything. The ones who are currently running TM.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of these things where like there's a utility in the practice, and then maybe it's my own failing. I know, and proximity and all this stuff. This is another interesting thing about all these things. Like maybe Roseanne knew this guy, Donnie Epstein. And I found proximity makes all of us just a little in our moral stances. And when you are close to somebody or know them or have seen them in a different way, it makes it harder for you to judge sometimes, because we want to be empathetic. We want to understand. We want to think the best of people. I'll say the practice of TM has been incredibly useful for me and for many, many, many people I know. And they've never asked me to do anything. But then I don't know, you know, they've never asked me because I have my own podcast. You know, I have a microphone and I have a big platform, and they know I would start talking about it.
Right.
Or is it because that's just not what they do?
Or you don't maybe project the need for it the way that other people might come into it.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, I will say I know Bob for a long time, and I believe that Bob and David Lynch are fully their intentions seem quite true and pure to me. Yeah. But you're right. Nobody knows.
I think you're right that people just need a room to cry in.
Yes.
And that whatever form that takes, whether it's talk therapy or, you know, yoga or TM or anything that just allows people to, like, be vulnerable in a space, that is something everybody needs.
Yeah.
And something that probably takes the place of religion for people who aren't religious.
Yes, I'm an atheist. So yeah, that, by the way, you just gave me the name of my next podcast, A Room to Cry.
Room to Cry.
That is, because people always say to me on my podcast, which is the moment, people always say to me, I feel like I'm in therapy, but A Room to Cry In is a really good podcast name.
Well, isn't that what they all are?
Well, you brought up Howard Stern. I think that's why Howard Stern gets such good interviews, because
people
it is
forget
like talk
they're on
therapy,
mic.
Yeah. Like in a in a way,
true.
Especially when you're in the room.
We all do now. We're all on mic all day.
Yeah.
In some way or another.
Got to use your voice in some way or another. Well, that was an excellent plug, Brian. Like seamless for the moment, which everybody should listen to.
Yeah, seamless.
And you're not on a hiatus or anything like that. You're still in the middle. Okay, great. So check out The Moment on iTunes, I assume. All the regular
you get your podcasts,
suspects. You can get it. Watch Billions on Showtime. Anything else to plug?
Nothing.
Okay, nothing. Just TM.
Well, you know, if you think you need it.
Yeah. No, I kind of want to.
Check it out.
Can you give our night call listeners a mantra if they don't want to spend money on TM?
A free mantra.
No.
They need a mantra.
It's
you won't do
no,
it.
No, you know what? Because you have to learn how to do it. Man.
Yeah.
I can't.
No freebies for you.
It's not the freebies. It's
you
not.
You got to find one within yourself.
No, if I.
You're not at the level yet.
I will tell you that they're called. It's a nonsense sound word that you repeat over and over to yourself. But I also don't want to send somebody off doing it without, I'll say an hour and a half with a teacher before you pay anybody anything, where they talk you through the whole thing, right? Then, or a lecture. Then if you want to do it, you take an hour lesson with the person, and then you come back for three more hour long sessions, and then that's it. Then you know how to do it. And then they ask nothing more of you. I mean, you do sign a few things about what to do with your income for the rest of your lives and how they're going to get it. I mean, of course, I don't feel that was an invasion in any way of anything.
You willingly signed it.
Really, I signed it. No, I mean, there's no. Then
right.
That's it.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today,
Brian.
Yeah, thanks so much, Brian.
My pleasure, guys.
And,
take care. Be well.
As always, give us a night call about chiropractic, about the gig economy, about anything at 1-240-46-NIGHT. Or give us a night email at nightcallpodcast@gmail.com.
You can also follow us on social media. Our Twitter is NightCallPod. Instagram and Facebook are both NightCallPodcast. And also, we would love if you would support our Patreon at patreon.com/NightCall. We're getting pretty close to our goal of $2,000 a month, at which point we will have a live call-in show.
Boop, boop.